G'day everyone, welcome to another episode of Ideas Matter Podcast. Back at you very soon, we're on the grind.
We are on the grind set.
We're going to churn out as much content for you guys as we can. But before we get into it, we have shout outs.
Yes.
We have shout outs because we said on social media, if you rate us 5 stars or you give us a rating on whatever platform, streaming platform you use to listen to this, we'll give you a shout out. So thank you to those who did do that. I'll give my shout outs and then Louis, you give yours. Give a shout out to Tulsi. Thank you very much. Thanks, Queen, for the recognition. And the big dog, the big man himself, Marty. Keeping it real.
Marty.
As always. Good on you, mate.
You, but you sound like a top bloke.
Top bloke and top lass.
Yeah, 100%. I've got Taylor Bland, who wrote a very kind review on Apple Podcasts.
Go, Taylor.
I've got Matt, or M-Dog, as he requested.
The big dog.
He knows who he is. And
good fella.
Abridged Book Reviews, who posted a very nice review on Instagram, and you guys should all go check them out on Instagram as well, Abridged Book Reviews.
They're the best book review account on Instagram. I've never had a look. I just know it because they gave us a good review.
Aside from the Ideas Matter Instagram as well.
That's they're the second best.
Yeah. These people are, they're the indispensable listeners. They see further into history than anyone else listening to this podcast.
If you didn't rate us 5 stars or you didn't rate us, then as Trotsky said, you are going to be in the dustbin of history.
Yeah, we'll forget about you when we become famous.
And then you'll be coming up to us saying, can we please get recognition for giving you a 5-star review? And we'll say, no, the boat's gone.
Yeah,
time has passed.
Some people charge. Some people make you like become subscribers on Patreon or whatever to get shout outs. We're doing it for free. So yeah, like if you do enjoy the podcast, the offer still stands. Give us a rating and then contact us on Instagram or Twitter, Ideas Matter Pod, on both of those platforms. And show us the rating and we'll shout you out in the next podcast. Or if you don't want, just rate anyway because that helps us gain some visibility. Share, tag us on Twitter, Instagram. I'm active on both of those accounts. So yeah, share the podcast, help us grow so more people can hear the podcast.
Get it done. We want to get those endorsements so we can start making money from this. We're going after the fracking endorsement. We want to be officially sponsored by fracking.
Yeah. Fuck. I don't know why that's so funny, but it is.
Yeah.
Well, no ethical qualms on this podcast.
Please help us get to the fracking endorsement.
Yeah. It's a dying industry. They need our support. Anyways, today I think we foreshadowed this at the end of the last podcast. We're doing 2 essays by Immanuel Kant. I'm going to resist the temptation to make terrible puns with his name. We're doing 2 essays because they're both kind of short. The first one is Idea for a Universal History with a Cosmopolitan Purpose. And the second one is What is Enlightenment? And they're both only about 10 or less than 10 pages each. And like I was kind of scared going into this. I was saying to you the other day that I feel like I need to read more primary texts. And, you know, you sort of have this view of Kant as being one of those really inaccessible philosophers. So I was kind of a little bit nervous. But it's really straightforward, both of these essays.
Yeah, very easy read. I was pretty out of a bit of trepidation going into this one because, you know, just being at a philosophy section in a bookshop and you see one of those big Kant books, like one of the critiques, and you flick it open and you tried to read the first page and it just doesn't happen. I couldn't figure out what was going on. But I read these and it's very easy, very accessible.
Yeah. I think I was with you at the bookshop one when I bought Critique of Pure Reason and you were like, you know, I'll give you $100 if you actually fucking read that. It's still sitting on my shelf. But I did pick it up and I read like the edited introduction or whatever. And I remember in that edited introduction, some guys talking about this philosopher like 100 or so years ago who was trying to read Kant, and like every morning he would wake up and he would read Kant, and then he would go on these long walks and he would like write in his diary that like reading Kant made him want to kill himself. and it was hugely depressing. So you get that start, you get that, but then you also get someone else who I know who claims that Kant's a very enjoyable read. So I don't know, how, you know, like his political readings were very enjoyable, but I can't speak for the critique of pure reason.
We just needed to level up our brains before we can.
Yeah,
we need to hit the brain gym.
Yeah, I think like you've said a few times that you do want to read more Kant, and so do I. And I think probably for us a good way into it is through the politics.
Yeah.
So this is probably a good place to start.
Yeah, good call.
Yeah. So they're fairly straightforward essays. I mean, the first one, Universal History, Idea for Universal History. I have a friend who I won't name because I haven't got his permission, but he said to me a few times that Hegel is just watered down Kant, and I didn't really know what he meant by that. But everyone probably listening to this podcast is familiar with Hegel, at least in the sense that Hegel has a theory of history, which gets picked up and interpreted by Marx. But when you read Kant, and Kant predated Hegel by a little bit, I understand what my friend meant now when he said Hegel is watered down Kant, because his Universal History essay is very, very similar or predates or anticipates Hegel's theory of history. I mean, obviously Hegel would have read Kant, but you don't really hear about Kant in that sense. But the way that he talks about history having a purpose, history's got a, he says you can determine regular progressions among freely willed actions, and on a large scale, human history has a purpose to it. This we usually attribute to Hegel, but reading this essay, you actually see it first in Kant.
Yeah, and it really hammers home the whole thing of philosophers being in kind of conversation with one another through time. Because all of these major figures in philosophy, when you're first getting into philosophy, they can all seem very separate from one another. And if you're kind of unfamiliar with their ideas, they all seem very foreign and apart from one another. But the more you look into it, the more you realize that there is this sort of, I don't know, continuous chain of influence and thought. And it's very easy to see where Hegel got his ideas from reading this.
Mm. Well, both are German idealists, so it does make sense. But yeah, so he divides the history essay into 9 propositions. It's structured like that. But I think a good way to come at this is to just tackle the first 4 in tandem and then the last 5. So he begins by saying freedom of the will, however you want to get to that belief in any metaphysical sense, our freedom is manifested in physical acts. It's manifested in the natural world, and anything in the natural world must follow natural laws. And so he says, well, can we, looking at human actions on a large scale, can we discern any sort of like reason, some sort of progression, some pattern that can explain human behavior over time on a large scale? He gives an interesting example. He's like, well, on an individual level, you can't predict when someone might have kids, but on a national level, you can predict the rise and fall of birth rates.
Yeah, like people think that they act independently, but like human actions, when you take them in aggregate, they follow certain patterns.
Exactly.
And his Kant supposes that these patterns follow some end. It's going towards some point.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's, he sort of sets all that up even before the first proposition. Mm. And then the first proposition...
Actually, before we get into that, he has this little aside where he says, well, it's not possible to present a systematic history of all human action and whatever in the same way that you could for maybe an animal, like explaining all of their behavior and whatnot, because humans act by reason and not by instincts. And he just has this little aside where he says, you couldn't write this systematic history as could be given for bees or beavers, for instance.
Yeah.
What the hell is that? It just got me thinking, like, a systematic history of beavers, and I think that would be a pretty nice thing.
A systematic history? Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what he means by that. Like, because I've heard other thinkers say that humans are the only ones who can have history. Mm. So I'm not sure what Kant really means by that. But yeah, it's... He says, so basically in his own words, this essay is an attempt to discover a purpose in nature behind this senseless course of human events. So I think that's pretty clear. And then he gets into the propositions to sort of set this up. And the first proposition, I think, is kind of controversial and might sort of makes or breaks the entire essay. It's that of teleology.
So what do we mean by teleology?
Yeah, so teleology is like an explanation by appealing to something's end. So the plant grows upwards because it's trying to get sunlight, or like a seed unfolds into a plant because its goal is to grow and become a plant, right? Mm. So it's explaining things by explaining the purpose behind their actions.
Right, so there's this idea that the nature of a thing is to work towards some end.
Exactly. Yeah, that's putting it quite nicely. So pretty much the first proposition is, he says, all the natural capacities of a creature are destined sooner or later to be developed completely and in conformity with their end. And then he calls this himself the teleological theory of nature. So before we can get into human history, he's kind of saying at the outset that everything develops according towards a destined end.
Mm-hmm.
Which, I don't know. It's not starting off on a great foot in my books.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. When you look at this from about 240 years worth of scientific progress since this was written, the idea that things by their nature, all living things by their nature, work towards some end is a little suspect. Because he mentions the idea that, well, it could also be the case that there's no teleology and like nature plays aimlessly and everything is just kind of run by chance.
Mm.
But he goes, no, that couldn't be the case, because then that wouldn't be... These aren't his exact words, but his sentiment is that wouldn't be good. So let's not worry about that.
Exactly. It's just sort of axiomatic to him that nature doesn't act in an aimless random process, to use his words.
Yeah, and this, I feel like this is such a common refrain. You can just predict that I'm going to say this at any podcast that we have. It's very Christian of him.
Yes, it is.
Very deeply Christian. I mean, the idea that there's like a purpose to all living things, like, I don't know, wisdom is an attribute of God that's woven throughout the universe, and we just need to discover the nature of that wisdom, and we can find the ends of things. Like, I feel like I keep saying this again and again, but it seems like there's a God-shaped hole in a lot of these ideas.
I completely agree. It's interesting because I'm like tutoring a first-year political philosophy subject at the moment, and one of the like themes of that subject is explaining the break in pre-modern and modern political thought.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting because if you read pre-modern political philosophers, well, not going back so far as Plato and Aristotle, but after the Greeks and before the moderns, the reference to God is very, very explicit, right? And we read Locke, and it was kind of interesting because you can see in Locke almost like an intermediary where he's referring to God, he's referring to nature, and he's referring to reason. He's referring to all three. And so he's still retaining the God element in his explanations. But then later philosophers will come along and they just kind of remove the God part. But they're talking about nature and reason. But historically, like, those three things go together. And nature has reason because God has reason and God creates nature. And it's sort of, yeah, you can remove the God thing, but the structure of the thought is the same.
Yeah, they kind of like retain the presuppositions that surrounded the God part.
Yep.
You just got rid of that specific one God part.
Absolutely. And I think this will make sense towards the end of the podcast when we talk about the what is enlightenment, the relationship between Kant's thoughts and an idea of God. But yeah, so the first proposition is basically just that things progress towards an end. Mm-hmm. So let's bracket that, like, you know, whether or not we think that's legitimate. The second proposition is that natural capacities, which are directed towards the use of his reason, are such that they could be fully developed only in the species, but not in the individual. I think this is a really interesting point because he says, like, unlike animals, humans have reason and that reason gets developed over time, but our lives are very, very short. And so we cannot fully develop our reason capacities in the space of a single human lifetime. But what is unique about humans is that we can learn from previous generations. And so as a species, we cumulatively develop over time. We get more reasonable because we're basically standing on the shoulders of giants.
Right, yeah. And there's one thing that he kind of just inserts here, which I feel like it ends up being very consequential for his whole argument and a lot of his thought, which is that humans are like fundamentally rational. Mm. Like he brings in this example of how do different creatures, different beings survive in nature? He says, well, the bull has its horns, the tiger has its claws and its teeth. Humans have their reason. That is how we kind of survive and go forward in the world. But yeah, like you said, this ends up being a cumulative thing. You know, a tiger doesn't really pass on extra teeth and claws to its predecessors.
Yeah.
I guess maybe in some like grand scale evolutionary sense, if that helps them thrive more in the environment. But it's not on the same like fundamental level as humans that the reason has for us.
Yeah, and he also like makes an inference there from say, well, look, animals have these things which help them survive in the wild. Humans don't, which must mean that like we're intended to use our reason. Mm. The fact that like nature didn't give us, you know, claws or teeth, but only gave us reason, must mean that like we're supposed to use this to, you know, further our capacities and develop.
Mm.
It sort of actually reminded me of like the idea of like humans developing as a species, reminded me of Marx's concept of species being.
Yeah.
Which I think we covered in the Philosophical Manuscripts episode, which basically is that like humans are unique because we have consciousness of ourselves as being part of a greater species. Like he said, history of bees or beavers,
mm.
but I think it was Alan Ryan, who's a modern political philosopher, who said like only humans can have history because humans are the only ones that have consciousness of themselves as a species.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this was an idea that we covered in one of the classes that I'm tutoring. And I thought like a quote that really nicely summarizes this idea of like species being and like humanity developing as a species was when Neil Armstrong landed on the moon. And he said, that's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Mm-hmm.
Like, obviously, like that sentence expresses the sentiment. Like,
right.
An individual doing this one act can actually be acting on behalf of a species and progressing the species. That's, I think, the idea that like both Kant and Marx are getting at.
Right. Yeah. You know, you can see that a beaver probably wouldn't be saying like one small step for beavers, one giant leap for beaver kind if you just, I don't know, ate like the biggest tree that a beaver has ever eaten.
Yeah. there's no concept of that act being for any sort of higher purpose belonging to the species.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting idea, I think. And we sort of just touched on the third proposition. The third proposition is what Alex just said about how nature gave man reason and freedom of will based upon reason. And this in itself was a clear indication of nature's intention as regards to his endowments. So nature didn't give us like big claws, big teeth. It gave us reason, so we're meant to be using it.
And also, a side effect of this reason is technology. I feel like this is something that's like sort of like implicitly in the argument. He does mention it kind of offhand, at least in the translation I read. It seems to kind of indicate that he thought technology and the advancement of technology is a natural extension of human reason. So it is part of human nature to build and develop technology.
Again, sounds very Marxist.
Yeah.
Although, you know, chronologically speaking, Marx perhaps sounds very Kantian.
Like he has this idea that as a part of this reason, like humans are kind of by nature striving and creative.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is an idea taken up very enthusiastically by Marx.
Mm.
So the fourth proposition, and then I want to discuss the first four as a whole. The fourth proposition is that these innate capacities, so that is our reason, and these develop over time in the species, the sort of causal mechanism that's triggering that development is what he calls the antagonism within society, the unsocial sociability of men. So the idea is here that there are two tensions pulling in opposite directions in human nature. One is that we want to live in a society, we want to be around other people. Man is a social animal, as Aristotle said. The other is that we also want to live as individuals, and in living with other people, sometimes we want to be alone and we want to do things that would adversely impact other people, or other people constrain our freedom. So we have these two tensions between being social and being individuals. And that antagonism is what drives the development of reason. It's that sort of simultaneous desire to be with other people, but also to dominate them. or to not let them overcome our freedom that creates these like creative energies that then spur the development of human history.
Yeah, like there's kind of a natural competitive element to human nature.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's so I was reading this again this morning and I thought, wow, like this, it kind of does sound like Adam Smith in a way. Or again, Adam Smith sounding like Kant, because Kant comes first. And you can really see Kant's influence here on the rest of Western thought, right?
Yeah, if you look, just as a kind of add in here, if you look up Kant on Wikipedia, and with philosophers on Wikipedia, it always comes up with a little section that says influences, like who influenced this thinker, and influenced, who did they later influence. The influence section for Kant just says virtually all subsequent Western philosophy.
Yeah. And like
and you can see it.
I'm just realizing this more and more because I read the first three chapters of The Wealth of Nations. But, you know, anyone who knows anything about Adam Smith, basically that like competition is good because it creates this creative tension, right? Like that's what's good about capitalism, according to Smith. And there's that famous quote that it's not the benevolence of the butcher or the baker from which we depend upon our next meal. It's their self-interest. Mm-hmm. And human self-interest is what drives our creative energies. And Kant literally says, each individual as he furthers his self-seeking pretensions. So again, it's this idea that like humans in being competitive with one another in a society is what spurs human development.
Right. This, I was surprised to read this here because I just didn't know what to expect from Kant. I've never actually read him before. And I didn't think that I'd see something like that in there. And I think I agree with it. It makes a whole lot of sense to me. The idea that humans are like, yeah, fundamentally social, but there's elements of the human condition that make people want to kind of push apart from each other and compete with one another.
Yeah.
And that the product of this competition ends up being things like, I don't know, technological advancement.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a dialectical way of thinking because you don't have to say on the one hand, no, humans are completely social and like the natural state of human affairs is harmonious and society corrupts that, which is what Rousseau said. And you don't have to say that humans are completely individualistic and humans are individualistic and living in society is purely like a contrivance for utilitarian purposes. Like both can be true and operate in tension with one another. So it's a sort of dialectical way of thinking that like two things can be true, which I think, yeah, does capture the nuance of human experience.
Yeah. I mean, he has this line in there where he says something along like humans feel more fully human when they're in association with one another.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, like he just adds on to that. Well, yeah, there's also this unsociable instinct, you know, that unsociability. It's a mouthful of a term, but it's a bit easier to see what he means by that when we go through that. And there's, yeah, that kind of interplay between humans wanting to stick around one another. You know, humans have an instinct towards being social. So you're not just going to go off and live in the woods because you're like, fuck this, I don't want to deal with these people anymore. But on the other hand, that fuck this instinct, you know, leads to the people wanting to accumulate power, wanting to accumulate honor, wanting to accumulate wealth. And what are some ways you can do that? Well, you can do that through, you know, just pure physical domination of someone. But you can also do that through, I don't know, status. Yeah. How do you gain status? I don't know, you invent things. How do you gain wealth? You invent new things. How do you gain those, you know, status and wealth as well? Well, you become a more rational person. You develop your rational capabilities so you become more useful, become more intelligent, and then you just become more, I don't know, you get more acclaim as a result.
The point about status is a good one because this is another sense in which Kant influences Hegel, and we find Kant's thinking later in Hegel's work, the importance of recognition to Hegel. So it's again, it's not that like humans could go, as Alex was saying, it's not that we can just go off and live in the forest by ourselves, because actually fundamental to our being is that we need recognition from others. You might remember this from the Confucian episode that we did, but like, you know, we're essentially like defined by our relationships with other people. And if I don't have anyone else like recognizing me, then my identity is incomplete. So the drive for status and the drive for recognition from others is something that, yes, spurs humans to, I guess, be ambitious and to seek wealth, seek power. It makes a lot of sense to me. It's not this kind of like crude capitalist humans just want money because they want money, or Hobbes kind of saying humans want power so they can get more stuff. It's a kind of a take that makes a lot of sense, that humans, being social, crave status and recognition from other humans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's in this kind of competition, competition for status and recognition, that allows for the full development of human potential, according to Kant at least, because this kind of striving for this kind of creative instinct of one-upsmanship pretty much ends up developing human reason and rationality. And like you said, previous generations end up creating things, creating inventions, creating ideas that benefit later ones. So this internal struggle is actually very productive for humanity.
Yeah, and he says we should thank nature for giving us these. He says, nature should thus be thanked for fostering social incompatibility, enviously competitive vanity, and insatiable desires for possession or even power. Man wishes concord, but nature, knowing better what is good for his species, wishes discord. And just incidentally, listen to the way that he talks about nature in that sentence. Nature, knowing what is good for his species. Mm-hmm. Like, you could just replace that with God.
Yeah.
I mean, really. But, so let's just recap before moving on to the last five propositions. So what's the purpose of this essay? Kant's trying to discover a pattern or a reason in human history. And so the first four propositions are, well, everything develops according to an end. The original capacities of humans are our capacity to think and have reason. These can't be fully developed within an individual. So if we want to look for the teleological purpose in humanity, we have to look at the species as a whole, and we have to look at it over the course of generations. And nature gave us this reason. And so it seems that we should actually, given the fact that nature hasn't given us anything else to help us survive, nature seems like the salient faculty here that we should be developing over time. And fourthly, this development is spurred by the unsocial sociability. So in society, we have this tension between humans and other humans and our desire to be with others and our desire to be alone. That's what's spurring this development of this original capacity, which, according to Kant, like all things, is developing towards an end. So they're the first four propositions, and then we go from there to politics, because...
Yeah, and it gets very interesting from this point. Like, I was still enjoying it with the first four propositions, but when you go from 5 to 9, it's kind of like a, oh, shit, that's where that comes from moment.
Yeah.
This ends up being very influential to, I guess, a lot of the institutions that we have today.
Influential to everything.
Yeah.
Everything. So the fifth proposition, it says, the greatest problem for the human species, the solution of which nature compels him to seek, is that of attaining a civil society which could administer justice universally. So all he means by that is, if we accept the previous four propositions, it's the purpose of human development to develop our capacities for reason. This isn't done individually. So how do we do this? Well, we've got to do it in a society. We've got to do it in a polis. We have to do it in a polity, right? So the fifth proposition is just that we need the right kind of society, a just society, very Greek, that's going to enable, I guess, almost like an equilibrium between these two tensions. So this is sort of how I read it. One that gives us enough freedom to do things that can enhance our status and to create wealth, but also constrains us such that in that quest we don't inhibit others.
Yeah, yeah. So is trying to kind of reconcile the competitive instinct and the social instinct, kind of like my right to swing my hand around ends where your nose starts.
Yeah.
This, actually, reading this part made me think of the episode from The Simpsons. Do you remember the ice hockey episode?
Where Lisa starts playing ice hockey?
Yeah, and so she starts competing with Bart, even at home, and then they get to some argument at home and Bart starts punching the air.
Oh, yeah.
And Lisa starts kicking the air. Well, they kind of just start walking towards each other, these two competitors, and then Marge comes in and tells them off, like, you can't be fighting each other like that, because they, punching the air and kicking the air ends up walking towards each other and actually getting in a fight.
Mm.
So for Kant...
Marge is the state.
Yeah, Marge is the ideal state as far as Kant is concerned, because, you know, he recognizes that there is these competitive instincts are necessary, but it's not productive for people just to be getting in fights all the time over it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So we have these two tensions, and how do we ensure that these tensions are productive and we don't just like tear each other to shreds? Well, we need a state and a society which basically strikes this balance between freedom and constraint. And of course, you know, Kant just goes, oh, well, you know, how great that we've found these things in Western Europe already. We call them republics.
He gives a very good argument as well, a kind of analogy. I thought it was very interesting, where he says, trees in a forest grow straight and tall and look beautiful because they're so bunched together, they can only find light upwards.
Yeah, I love that analogy. That's a
but
really good one.
But trees far apart, you know, that are very individually spaced, grow very crooked and bent and kind of warped. They don't look nice. And this is kind of analogous to humans in society. Well, people might not want to live with one another, you know, with this competitive instinct, but it's necessary for human flourishing for them to do so. Yeah. We want to have humans such that they grow straight and tall and look beautiful rather than grow far apart and be all crooked.
Yeah, it's a really apt analogy. The sixth proposition is sort of related to this point, because he says, humans are such that we need a master. We can sort of rationally recognize that this like constraint on our freedom might be good for us and will be good for the species as a whole. But there's always that tragedy of the commons, the free rider problem, whatever you want to call it. Like, everyone else can follow the rules, but like if I ignore them, then I get the most utility. So this is again a danger that we run into. So Kant says, well, humanity is such that we need a master, but we can only find that master in another human, and that human is also going to be a flawed human with the same tendency to want to ignore the rules while everyone else follows them. So again, you kind of see these liberal ideas of checks and balances and a civil constitution, like,
yeah.
We follow the ruler, but the ruler is constrained by a constitution. We kind of see all this starting to take shape.
Right. He pretty much leaves off this idea of who watches the watchman.
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. So they're propositions 5 and 6, which are very interesting. But from 7 onwards, we get into international relations theory.
And yeah, I can see you rubbing your hands right now.
I'm getting very excited because I'm reading this and I'm like, okay, like this all makes sense, you know, like humans, we leave the state of nature, or according to Kant, we were never really in it. We were always in a society. But that's fine if, like, say, Germany creates a perfect republic. Mm-hmm. But if it's surrounded by, you know, absolute monarchies who are warlike, then this freedom that the average German has is not going to get them very far. So Kant, you know, Kant's a smart guy. He anticipates this argument. So he's like, well, yeah. The problem of establishing a perfect civil constitution is subordinate to the problem of a law-governed external relationship with other states and cannot be solved unless the latter is also solved. So if we just return to the state of nature analogy, individuals in a state of nature are in a warlike relationship with each other. They might solve this by coming together, but then we can think of states in a state of nature relationship with other states. Mm-hmm. So anarchy prevails at the international level, even if domestically we've created a perfectly civil constitution. And so this is a problem.
Yeah, like people, states are inherently competitive, but unlike people, at least in Kant's time, there was nothing above the state to kind of manage that competition.
Yeah. So, but in the same way, we need to overcome it. And again, he sees the same mechanism at work here. It's this antagonism between wanting to be unsocial and wanting to be social. And so he has this really interesting discussion where he talks about wars. He says, wars, tense and unremitting military preparations, and the resultant distress which every state must eventually feel. These are the means by which nature drives nations to make initially imperfect attempts, but finally, after many devastations, to take the step which reason could have suggested to them even without so many sad experiences, that of abandoning a lawless state of savagery and entering a federation of peoples in which every state could expect to derive its security and rights, not from its own power, but solely from this great federation. So there's two things I want to say about this. First is that, like, he almost sees war on a grand sort of historical scale as a manifestation of this antagonism. So it's kind of like a natural phenomena that occurs, but as a result might have some beneficial consequences, which is an interesting idea that wars might have some sort of higher purpose.
Yeah, like I don't know if I read it right, but I noted that he kind of sees it, he sees war as a sort of like corrective mechanism, yeah, or like a sorting mechanism through which states kind of correct their relations between each other. And the internal organization of a state is also kind of influenced by, and over time, like human competition, this will lead to the formation of sort of an equilibrium.
Yeah, it does actually, like you can look at history and make sense of it. Like after the 30 Years' War, you get the Treaty of Westphalia, in which like European nation states said that they would respect the internal governance of the other state. So like in a state's domestic affairs, it is sovereign. We get this idea after the 30 Years' War. And after World War One, we get the League of Nations. After World War Two, we get the United Nations, and we get like international treaties about human rights. So you can kind of see the idea that Kant's trying to get at here. Like as horrible as war is, it almost in a sense pushes humanity forward.
Yeah. And he adds in here that, well, humanity should establish what, at least in my translation, is called a federation of peoples.
Mm.
So he's sort of like predicting a sort of like League of Nations or a UN sort of institution here, where all states have their security and rights guaranteed, quote, from a united power and from the decision based on laws of the united wills. So you're saying that there should be some sort of body whereby the kind of like arbitrates competition between states, and doesn't matter within that body whether or not one state is more powerful than another. It just matters what the collective will of all of those states together is. So he's arguing for some sort of international state-based democratic body.
Yeah. I mean, you could even say that like the European Union is sort of like, it takes a lot of this logic, right?
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, the European Union like came out of World War II originally with like what was it called?
I forget the name, but it's like some, yeah, steel and coal, yeah, trading agreement.
Yeah, exactly. It was like, you know, because France and Germany were, you know, fighting for so many years over this area of Europe that had heaps of coal. And they're like, well, why don't we just like have a customs free trade area when it comes to steel and coal? Like, yeah, eliminate this friction point. And then that becomes the European Union slowly over time. It's a very like similar sort of idea. But obviously it's easier when you have cultural similarities. So then we get to the eighth proposition, and we're almost done here with this essay. This is where it's almost like a conclusion. He says, the history of the human race as a whole can be regarded as the realization of a hidden plan of nature to bring about an internally, and for this purpose also externally, perfect political constitution. So that's the purpose of human history, mm-hmm, is to advance towards this perfect constitution.
And again, just to draw it back to what he was talking about earlier, what is the point of this perfect constitution? Well, it's also for humans to reach the full development, the full realization of their reason.
Mm.
So he's saying that as long as states, war has kind of a purpose to a point, but as long as states devote resources to, you know, militaries and to expansion and defense, and don't focus on cultivating the minds of their citizens, then full human development can't be expected. So that's how he jumps to this idea of, well, we need to have some sort of like mediating factor. And part of that mediating factor is, it's a part of like the grand sweep of human history.
Yeah. And he gives some indication of how he thinks that this world state or UN or whatever you want to call it, Federation of Peoples, will come about. And this is really just the building blocks of democratic peace theory, or the idea of like interdependence. Economic interdependence causes peace, which we hear a lot about today with like the US and China, for example. Well, this isn't going to be a new Cold War because they're so economically intertwined. Kant pretty much, like, he just gives the building blocks for that argument right here. He goes, well, over time, states are going to become more and more interdependent, and so the benefits of going to war will be more and more ambiguous, and it will be uncertain who's going to win, and every country will have a stake in other countries going to war. I mean, so look at like the war in Ukraine now, for example. Like every other country is scared about this escalating. Every other country has a stake in it. It's not a European security issue. It's in a sense a global security issue. And so other countries will offer to arbiter. They'll offer to mediate, according to Kant. And we see this happening. We see I think Israel has, you know, offered to host Putin and Zelensky, and so has Turkey, and other states see it in their interest to stop other states going to war. And so because of this interdependence, the globe will eventually move towards this system of federation and you'll have peace, which is basically liberal interdependence theory.
Right. And there's actually a little bit at the beginning of this proposition where he says right at the start, look, this is pretty much like what's called millenarianism in Christian thought, with, you know, this idea that Christ will return and then we'll have like 1,000 years of peace on earth and there'll be the kingdom of heaven on earth. So like pretty much the idea that there's like an end of history and that we'll reach this end and we'll have like, it'll just be complete salvation and everybody will be living in some sort of paradise on earth. And he says, yeah, it is pretty much millenarianism, but you know, it's not just some completely faith-based thing. He says, this is one that can promote its own realization. We're not relying on something outside. This is something that is inherent to humans.
Hmm.
So that's like I said at the start, there's sort of a God-shaped hole here, but he kind of by the end, he recognizes that and he says, look, I can see the God-shaped part of this argument. I can see how this relates to Christian thought, but that doesn't mean that we can't achieve it as people without some sort of outside spiritual factor helping us bring that about.
Yeah, just by how human beings are so constituted, this antagonism, our, what is it, unsocial sociability or social unsociability, whichever way it's formulated, like regardless of God, like you don't need God for that to work. Like that's just in humans. And so that antagonism will create this anyway.
Yeah, for sure. And yeah, it's just really, really odd to see these ideas about international global governance being talked about back in like, when was this written? Like 1784?
Yeah, the 1700s.
Yeah. Like it's just very odd to read about something that's so recognizably modern back over 200 years ago.
Maybe in a sense vindicates his theory. You know, we are sitting here reading him and building on previous generations and developing our reasonable faculties as a species. You know, there aren't beavers reading, you know, what is an idea for universal history for beaver kind, you know, like, but there are humans doing that.
I just want to see what the beavers can get up to if we leave them for like 10,000 years.
We just leave the earth, come back, see what they got up to. I just want to say one critical thing, right? Because if we accept Kant's argument that like a state which creates this perfect balance with freedom helps humans develop their rational capacities more so than a society which doesn't have freedom, you can sort of see that very easily being like, oh, well, look, republics or liberal democracies, as we call them today, they create citizens which are more rational and have their reasonable faculties more developed. And so you can see this very easily being interpreted in a racist way and like looking at other societies, non-Western societies, and saying, because of the way that their system of government is set up, they're not fully rational, right? It's a very, very, that's not even a jump. It's literally just a step from that argument to the other argument, in my opinion. And look, he says in brackets, he's talking about the development of political constitutions on our continent, so obviously he's referring to Europe. And then he says in brackets after that, which will probably legislate eventually for all other continents. So because Europe's got there first, it's reached the end of history first, but this is just like a mirror of the future of the rest of the world, then it's in a sense legitimate for these Western republics to go around the world and tell everyone else how to get there.
Right. So what you're saying is we should invade Afghanistan and build a liberal democracy.
Yeah. Or Iraq or anywhere. Like we should intervene or these liberal ideas, you know, you can be really charitable when you're reading Kant and like they're very well-intentioned, but this is more so getting into the what is enlightenment stuff, which we will in a sec, but I don't know. I don't even want to get into that critique now. It's not going to make sense if we don't discuss the what is enlightenment.
Right. So that brings us up to the ninth proposition then. So this is the final part of the essay. Quote, a philosophical attempt to describe the universal history of the world according to a plan of nature that aims at the perfect civic union of the human species must be considered to be possible and even to promote this intention of nature. So what he's saying here pretty much is, going off the argument that we just went through, that, you know, there's kind of like a teleology to human nature, and this teleology involves the idea that human kind of rationality and human culture, human ideas progress along a certain line, and that there's an end point to this line. Well, we need philosophical attempts for people to describe this, because that in itself helps bring that about.
Mm.
So this is pretty much like a call to action. Like, you want to do something about this? Well, go nuts. Let's try to describe it, and that way we can make it influential.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting idea. It's kind of like, by becoming conscious of this like subconscious process, we help it along.
Mm-hmm.
And so by, like, he calls it a hidden plan of nature, but by becoming aware of this hidden plan of nature, you know, we are part of nature in a sense. So we, like, our awareness of it is part of this process, and it, like, speeds it up. It further accelerates it. And I sort of jumped ahead a little bit when I was talking about the quote where he says, Europe will eventually end up legislating for the rest of the world, because that's in this ninth proposition. But that's the logic behind that statement. Like, well, once we've become aware of this plan of history, well, we should want to help bring it about.
Mm.
So there's a sort of, you know, this is getting a little bit into IR theory, but this is kind of what I've been suggesting for a while now, that like liberal internationalism slides very quickly into liberal imperialism, because if you believe that you're standing at the rational end of history, you want to go around the world and help other people get there, because you think, well, they're going to get there eventually, so why prolong their ignorance, right? Why prolong their suffering? We have a desire, we have a impetus to go around and help speed up this process of history.
Right. I feel like this part is where he explains a lot more of the Hegelian sort of stuff. Like, you can really see where Hegel picks this stuff up. Like, you said earlier that he has this idea of, like, the history of humanity, like, from a long-term perspective, shows progression. Like, when one civilization falls or is conquered by another, the what he calls like the seed of enlightenment passes and develops from one to the next.
Mm.
So this is kind of like that Hegelian dialectic thing. It's literally just this. Like, he says, well, ancient Greek civilization was overtaken by Roman civilization, which retains many aspects of Greek civilization. Roman civilization in turn was conquered by, you know, the Gothic, you know, German quote unquote barbarians, who retained a lot of the Roman aspects of civilization, and that seed of enlightenment, that seed of accumulated human progress and knowledge, is passed from one to the next.
Yeah.
And even when there's something that might be considered a downturn, like the Goths conquering the Romans, a lot of people consider that a massive decline in human history, but Kant's saying, no, that had to happen because something was passed along and something new came from that.
Yeah.
Like, that's literally just Hegel's dialectic.
Yeah, it does remind me of when Hegel says, like, even when we get these, like, epoch changes, even when we go from, say, feudalism to capitalism or whatever, I think Hegel says at some point, like, it's not that 100% of what was there is lost.
Mm.
You know, even though we do change and we improve, we still retain things from previous generations, from previous eras of human history. And, yeah, from the Greeks you get, arguably it's not from the Greeks, but you get democracy for simplicity's sake, and then from the Romans we get this idea of everyone standing equal before the law. And so you take both these things, and even though, as you said, like, Rome collapsed, like, that idea was retained and then affected in, you know, former parts of the Roman Empire, and human history develops as such.
Yeah, and he has this quote that I feel really encapsulates it. A seed of enlightenment always remained, which developed further through each revolution and prepared a subsequent, even more greatly improved stage.
Yeah, stages of human development.
There you go.
Occurring over the course of many generations.
And there's also, just before we jump into the next thing, there's an interesting thing at the end here where he says, well, future generations studying the past, quote unquote, from a cosmopolitan perspective, will be concerned with, quote, what peoples and governments have achieved or harmed. And when he says from a cosmopolitan perspective, like, he pretty much means the mindset that he's laying out about human freedoms and human rights and justice and enlightenment. And this prediction was completely true, because you look at how people engage with certain periods of human history, and it's not so much how they would have engaged with it in history, like, who are the great people? What are their you know, conquests or whatnot? It's about, you know, the rights of certain groups and the layout of society within those societies. So, what peoples and governments have achieved or harmed from a cosmopolitan perspective, that is pretty much the lay of the land when you look at contemporary historical scholarship.
Yeah, pretty much. He says that, like, you know, from a cosmopolitan perspective, we should observe the ambitions of rulers and their servants, to indicate to them the only means by which they can be honourably remembered in the most distant ages. And so in my notes, I wrote down in quotes this idea of being on the, quote, wrong side of history.
Right.
And you see this today when, like, Western countries tell other countries not to be on the wrong side of history.
Mm.
It's very interesting. They're saying, well, like, they're, number one, assuming that history is going to continue to develop and progress along liberal lines. And then in the future, from that more liberal standpoint, we will look back and we will judge people according to that standard. And we will judge countries and leaders according to did they or did they not help bring about this purpose of nature.
Right. And this just reminds me, I remember talking to a friend and I don't know how, I mentioned something about, like, Genghis Khan. And they were like, wasn't he a really bad guy? And I was like, well... That just kind of encapsulates the mindset a little bit, I think, because I feel like with a massive historical figure such as that, it kind of, you're hamstringing yourself if you make the moral judgment before you actually have a look at their influence and their impact on history. But the common view and the view that kind of develops from what Kant is saying here is, well, you sort of proceed from the judgment.
Yeah. It also reminds me of when people, like, as a sort of a moral opprobrium, they say, they express their view that something is bad by saying, in the year 2022, this could happen.
Yeah.
Well, you think about how philosophically loaded, like, that statement is. Like,
in the year of our Lord, 2022.
How could someone be so barbarous, you know? I mean, look, it may very well be that they're describing something that is in fact horrible, but, like, that there's so much implicit in that statement, I feel, that, like... Yeah. History progresses, and how could someone in this year think something that is, you know, we have relegated to a previous era? Such an interesting, like, people always ask me why I like philosophy, and this is why, because you see how much is implicit in what we just take for granted.
You could say that we are becoming enlightened.
We are becoming enlightened. Wow, that's the best segue I've ever heard. Kant says, are we in an enlightened age? No, but we are in an age of enlightenment. So what does that mean? An answer to the question, what is enlightenment? The second essay we're considering today. He really just sums this up, and I mostly want to ad-lib for most of this because it's just, like, literally 5 pages. But he says at the start, enlightenment is man's emergence from his self-incurred immaturity. Immaturity is the inability to use one's own understanding without the guidance of another. So basically, think for yourself, man.
Yeah. Bro, don't be a coward. Don't let someone else think for you.
Yeah. What do you mean, like, you think something because someone else said so? That's so immature.
Yeah. Bro, don't be a lazy coward.
Yeah, pretty much. That's basically, like, that's a wrap, guys. Like, that's what is enlightenment. that's the essay. But it's, like, no joke. That's the whole point. But it is, it's very interesting, and its shortness kind of belies how interesting and how important this essay really is. And I'm drawing a lot here on this secondary work, which I should give credit to. It's a chapter from a book by John Rundell, who's Australian.
The Rundog.
Yeah, teaches here at the University.
Of Melbourne,
best city in the world. He was a really good chapter, actually, and it's his chapter on freedom, Kant's conception of freedom, and he calls it freedom as release from self-incurred tutelage. So it's this idea that, like, freedom is basically thinking for ourselves, right? Which sounds kind of banal and trivial, but I think it's interesting because we've been saying previously how a lot of this thought kind of just comes out of, like, appealing to God, and Kant's saying, well, why are you appealing to God? Why are you appealing to these transcendent or metaphysical ideas to justify what you're saying? It's very liberal in the sense that... a good way of summarizing liberalism politically is that, like, social relations or social institutions should be explicable and justifiable to people according to reason. You can't just say, oh, but that's just how things are. That's just tradition.
It is what it is.
It is what it is. Like, things have to have reasons to be justified, and those reasons need to be understandable and explicable to a human person. You can't just say, well, that's just how God willed it. And if you think like that, if you sort of outsource your critical thinking, your ability to think for yourself, to some sort of higher ideal, then according to Kant, you're being immature.
Right. So he has this, well, I have a different translation here, so it would probably read a bit different than yours, but he has this line, dogmas and formulas are the fetters of an everlasting immaturity. Oof. So this, like, he talks about this in the sense of, he spends a lot of time talking about, like, freedom of religious thought, you know, and that if you're, say, like a priest or a pastor with a particular church, you shouldn't be bound by the dictates of that church in your own private scholarly writings. But this kind of goes for everything. He's saying, well, in anything that you think, in any topic that you're interested in, you shouldn't be bound by, like, the prevailing ideas and the formulas you've been given to think about things, because that's not you thinking for yourself. If you're just relying on what someone else has given you, you need to, if you rationally come to the same conclusion as whatever, say, like the prevailing opinion might be, or whatever some formula is for thinking about things, well, that's completely fine, but most people don't do that. Mm. You need to step outside beyond that. But I really like the part where he makes a point of saying, like, exercising one's own understanding is like learning how to walk. Like, you're going to stumble. Like, you're not, when a baby learns how to walk, they can't just, you know, break out into a sprint the first time they stand up. They stand up, they trip over, you know, they have to hold on to something. They might hobble a little bit. And it takes some time. But most people become discouraged when it comes to the process of learning how to think for themselves.
That's true.
What he's saying is, well, yeah, you're going to fall over. You're going to tumble a bit when you're first trying to figure this stuff out. You're going to think and say some stuff that's sort of stupid and it's going to get, like, swatted down. But you need to learn how to develop that. You need to work through that pain.
Look, it's very easy for me to beat myself up for being a new atheist and thinking Christopher Hitchens was, like, the smartest man who ever lived. And now I watch him today and I'm like, oh, God, that's so cringe. But, you know, like, this takes time. You're not going to, at the age of 16, be reading Kant. You know, you're going to be listening to, I don't know, the Sam Harris podcast or something. Like, it's a process of trial and error, and we shouldn't really hate on people because it's a cumulative process of learning to think for yourself. But I did just want to quickly go back on something that you said, because you said something really instructive where you were like, even if people end up coming to the same conclusion themselves, which might seem like a distinction without a difference, but for Kant, it's not, right? And one thing I do know about Kant from his other writings is that for Kant, a moral law, a law is only valid morally if, like, humans themselves can rationally assent to it. So this is this whole idea that, like, moral law is because we can see rationally in our own mind why an action is right and wrong, and we can therefore willingly assent to it, that a law has its force. And so similarly, if you are just unknowingly going along with someone else, with what someone else says, you can't really rationally assent to it. It actually doesn't have any force because you've not in your own mind understood it and therefore consciously assented to it.
Mm, and you're not acting morally at that point.
Exactly. So it's not a distinction without a difference, even if in exercising your reason, you just come back to the same conclusion. It is actually a valid distinction according to Kant.
Mm. Yeah. It's crazy how much of, when you read, you know, the previous essay, like Universal History, and you read What is Enlightenment?, how much of it is just embedded in, like, the kind of, I don't know, like, a mainstream liberal mindset that we grow up with in the West today. Mm. Like, so much of this reads completely naturally, but this was, like, a massive, I don't want to say, like, a massive break, but this was, like, a real paradigm shift in the way people thought about things when he was writing this.
Absolutely, absolutely. I sort of paraphrased in my notes about what enlightenment is, and as I've written, it's the ability to think for ourselves without recourse to anything other than reason. And so in this John Rundell chapter, which is really good, he sort of says, well, you know, Kant wanted reason to have a solidity to it, to have a universal validity. So he says, well, all humans have reason. It's a sort of a universal faculty. So therefore, something which is justified according to reason is therefore universal. And what I want to posit is that, like, reason here is functionally performing the same role as a sort of transcendent justification as God does or any other sort of metaphysics. By saying that reason is this like universal thing that everyone can access, and when they access it, they're going to come to the same conclusion because reason is universal, it's just playing the same role that God, this idea of God plays, or any other way that you want to ground your ethical framework, it's the same thing.
If you look at the Old Testament and you read the book of Proverbs, there's, before they get into just listing Proverbs, there's a part at the start where they talk about how, like, I mentioned this a little bit earlier, like wisdom is an attribute of God, and that this attribute of God, wisdom, is woven throughout the universe. Mm. So it's everywhere, it's all pervasive, and everybody can access this wisdom. And this wisdom all goes along the same sort of lines. It's by, you know, following God's commandments that you're in touch with his wisdom. And it's really like a hop, skip, and a step to get from that, you know, God's wisdom throughout the universe to nature's wisdom.
Yeah, or nature's reason.
Yeah, nature's reason.
Everything has reason. And look, a lot of this is just the Enlightenment, right? Like the Enlightenment... It's like, oh, well, there's these, like, we can discover natural laws, we can discover a reason to the natural world, and then social scientists pick that up and they go, well, we could say the same thing about, like, human affairs. We can discover, like, laws and regular occurrences, and we can rationally understand things, and then we can politicize that and have a scientifically based politics, which is trying to understand the world in a rational way, which is liberalism and socialism. But yeah, look, it all just seems to me like part of this long lineage of thought which thinks about the world in a very peculiar way. But if, you know, if being enlightened and not being immature is to think for oneself without recourse to this sort of like higher thing, can we not say that like thinking by saying, well, this is helping the purpose of history, I mean, capital H history then also performs that function, which Kant would have wanted to avoid. We can read Kant against Kant and say, well, if we're like, look at Fukuyama's End of History, like it's this sort of appealing to this like higher abstract goal, which seems to defeat the whole purpose of what Kant wants us to do, which is to think for ourselves.
Right. So Kant is not being Kantian enough.
Kant's not being Kantian enough. It's a reading Kant against Kant. But could you, like, this is what I keep coming back to. Like, could you actually do what Kant wants you to do? Like, is it psychologically possible for a human to, quote, think for themselves? I don't think that it is. I mean, look at how embedded we are in this tradition and how embedded Kant is in what came before him. I don't actually think it's possible for us to achieve the sort of transcendence, this transcendental idealism that Kant wants us to achieve.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, you look at Kant here, and he, even though he has this, like, obviously a genius of a person, he has this, like, great kind of rationally built-up system, he can't seem to take off the goggles that he grew up with in order to see the world. And I don't think anybody can take off their goggles.
And you can
put effort into trying to, like, kind of work around it or recognize the fact that you have goggles and what sort of color are those goggles and how does that impact how you see things. But I don't think those goggles can ever come off.
No, I completely agree. It's just an impossibility. And if you were to do that, what would replace it would not be a form of understanding, right? And incidentally, this is like literally the critique of pure reason. Like, you can't just purely rationalistically understand things. Like, humans have certain things that are embedded in their faculty of understanding, such as concepts are embedded in our faculty of understanding, which help us interpret the world. And we can never transcend those concepts. So maybe my critique is actually not a critique of Kant, because he does sort of end up making that point. And Zizek says similar things about ideology. Everyone's probably seen the clip, you know, eating from the trash can all the time. The name of that trash can is ideology. We can't take off the glasses.
Yeah.
And actually, the ideology is not glasses. It's actually our eyes. Like, it's just built in us that we interpret the world in a way that's contextually embedded. So, I don't know, man. I don't know what to make of Kant. I think there's a lot of it that's very, as an ideal, it's a good one. but it's also perhaps a little bit blind and naive to reality, and it also can, being blind to its own embeddedness, can create a fake sense of universality, which can then be, I guess, used against the non-Western world in a very imperial way.
Like we were joking about before the podcast, when you get high level enough in philosophy, it just loops back around into some dude who just ripped a bong. It's all just your perspective, man.
Yeah, it kind of does come full circle. Just think for yourself, man. Like,
But I don't know. I guess you could kind of like weave a bit of critique of Kant into Kant, like you've been doing, where you could go beyond the limits of Kant's own sort of like Western-centered kind of imperial implied thought and take the seeds of other traditions and other modes of thought and try to build on from there, like you attempt to do through Confucianism.
That's true. That's true. And look, a mate of mine who's writing about Kant, and his supervisor is John Rundell.
Oh, damn.
Whose chapter, yeah, this is, that's why he sent me this chapter. I raised these points to him, and he was like, yeah, I agree. And the whole point of his thesis is Kant's idea of the imagination. And he is saying, in Kant's concept of the imagination, that is where we achieve pure transcendence. And that is when humans can actually come up with something completely new that was not already given in some sense in their facticity or their social embeddedness. It is our faculty of imagination. So it's not a rational, analytic faculty that enables us to achieve this sort of transcendence. It's the faculty of imagination. And to access that, we need the sublime and we need aesthetics. So that's how he connects aesthetics to this Kantian idea of transcendence. And so we are going to have him on the podcast at one point.
I was going to say we should get him on.
Yeah, because this all, now having read this, what he's been talking about is starting to make a lot more sense to me. So we will get he who shall not be named as yet on our podcast, because I think this is a very interesting area of discussion.
Yeah, I think that's a great place to end it off.
Yeah, and next we're doing The Social Contract, right, by Rousseau?
By Rousseau, and then after that we have the album Confessions by Usher.
Yeah.
I believe 2004 R&B classic.
Yeah. Gonna...
doing Confessions by St. Augustine.
Yeah. Why are we doing Confessions by St. Augustine?
Because we're going to become Catholic.
Yeah, that is the arc of this podcast.
Recognizing the... how embedded Western thought is in Christianity, and we're just going, yeah, fuck it, we'll just go Christian.
Isn't that Heidegger? Wasn't Heidegger like, whoa, you have to recognize that we're just like thrown into history at a certain point and we can't ever escape our facticity. So it's kind of like pointless to struggle against it, and you should just embrace your facticity. And so he was like, yeah, well, I just happened to be in Nazi Germany, so... I'm a Nazi now, like, I don't know. We can cut all this out, but like...
No, we got to leave that.
Like, isn't that just Heidegger? Like,
I've never read Heidegger, so I'll just take your word on that.
I don't know.
I don't recommend becoming a Nazi, by the way.
No, well, no, obviously neither do I.
No, you've been endorsing that.
No, one thing I did want to say was the reason we're reading Rousseau is because someone contacted us on Instagram and requested Rousseau, although admittedly they requested The Origins of Inequality, which is like 500 pages. So we're not going to do that, but we are going to do Rousseau, and we're going to do The Social Contract. All of this is to say that we do respond to requests, and that was the first request we had, and we are actioning it. So if there's something that you want covered, hit us up.
Yeah, and it doesn't even necessarily have to be something that's like within the tradition of like Western political philosophy. If you just have something like broadly philosophical or whatever that you want us to read, even from like a different tradition, like Chinese or Indian philosophy or what have you, like if it's an achievable length, we'll give it a go.
Yeah, absolutely. We will give it a red hot crack.
All right. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Don't forget to share the podcast.
Five stars.
Five stars. All right. See ya.
Laters.